Lovely, isn't it?
Yeah. I like the stones.
I do, I love the stones. It's very keeping with the surrounding countryside,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It's kind of very different as well.
It is. Yeah. It is very, very, I think, very nice.
We're here now at his gravesite, where he was buried in 1967. And it's a very simple layout. Just a lot of flagstones, stones that crossed the stream near his home, and the inscription on one of the stones is, "There were stepping stones across the stream, part of my life was there, the happiest part." Cavanagh's funeral made him. People began to realise that this wasn't just Patrick Cavanagh, the man from Mucker. There was something more to it. With the type of people who came that Saturday evening to his burial or to his funeral. Men of all, I suppose, denominations, from actors to solicitors to barristers to Dáil deputies at the time and all that. They all came and surprised the people of Inniskeen that this man had such power behind him. He was buried here on that Saturday evening, and the man that gave the oration or the talk for his gravesite was Seamus Heaney, the Ballaghy poet. And he said that the likes of Patrick Cavanagh, he said, would never walk the roads of County Monaghan again. That was something very big coming from Seamus Heaney.
He died in the Merion nursing home, which was a very expensive Dublin nursing home. He was being cared for there on a daily basis. He had a 24-hour nurse around the clock. Catherine insisted on that he would be well looked after. And then he had a friend who acted almost like his personal physician, this friend Richard Reardon, Dickie Reardon, who was the best man at his wedding. And he was in and out of the hospital all the time. And of course, you had the usual hospital staff as well. So he was very, very well looked after in those last days. But he was, at that stage, he had already lost a lung. He'd been drinking heavily. His body was just exhausted.
I work here as a tour guide in the Patrick Cavanagh Centre since 1994, actually, since it opened. I take people around all the places that Cavanagh mentioned in his poetry. The great fear, I suppose you could say, among the people of Inniskeen, and especially among his family, was when he went to dabble in verse, as he said himself, that he was going to turn out to be another bard. And they didn't want another bard. They had one and they had enough of him. And there were several others as well, doing bits and pieces. But Cavanagh wasn't a bard, you could say, as such. He was a poet.
Ladies and gentlemen.
And a damn good one.
You're all very welcome to this once-in-a-lifetime sort of a day. My sincere thanks for being so patient. It was a hectic afternoon from the moment Rosanna arrived to the Phoenix Centre, where she made a great sing-song and chat with students from the area. But right now, before we speak to Rosanna, I'm going to call on Ruth Cullen, with very strong Monaghan connections, to open this little impromptu get-together with a song called Fields of Gold. So can you give a big card across like to Ruth Cullen?
Cavanagh, Cavanagh, Cavanagh. 100 years after the birth of the poet, our country celebrates, and the celebrations begin on the streets of Carrickmacross, South Monaghan. Back in June, Miss World Rosanna Davison launched a literary tour.
You can tell some.
My name is Father Vincent Connolly. I'm parish priest here in Carrickmacross, and this is a wonderful day for the town and for Inniskeen and for the whole of South Monaghan. It's a great occasion to have with us today the Miss World opening this particular year of Paddy Kavanagh's centenary year. Paddy was well known around South Mon and well known around Carrickmacross. Paddy himself, a wonderful poet, very spiritual poet, and I'm delighted to be here and to experience this wonderful occasion.
Right now, we're just going to call Rosanna to unveil the plaque, one of 18. This one has her own name on it. And then there'll be a photograph, first with the Kavanagh Literary Trail, and then with all the public representatives. And then any other photographs that people want after that. She's been brilliant all day. She's signing autographs, etc., etc. So I'm just now going to call upon Rosanna to come forward and unveil the plaque with the Kavanagh Literary Trail Committee.
Keep it going, Rosanna.
Rosanna.
All right, Councillor Joe Quigley, Mayor of Carrickmacross Town Council.
Mayor Quigley, what does it mean to you today to be here on the opening of the Patrick Kavanagh Literary Tour?
It means a great deal to me to be the representative of the people of Carrickmacross and, you know, to have such a turnout here to honour the great work of Kavanagh. And, you know, the work is all linked with areas in the town, and it's just a great honour to be here today at this opening. You know, like, Kavanagh was a South Monaghan man from this area, and it's somebody we were all, you know, have to be very proud of. And, like, Kavanagh spent vast majority of his youth in this area. And, you know, like, it comes to the time now where a lot of towns and areas have to get up and defend themselves with tourism and everything. And this is an effort that's been made now to boost the tourism in this area. I think Kavanagh, like any other man, would be delighted to see Miss World, Miss Rosanna Davison here in his honour. I think he would be more than proud, and to see the turnout of people here today, I think Kavanagh, no matter what people say, he would be more than happy with this occasion.
When I was young, he was, you know, on the buses and everywhere, and he'd always write about everyone, but he wouldn't mention their names, you know, he'd for a different name for them. And like, he was very poor, and the shops had closed when they see him come. They didn't want, he'd have to walk over to Kelly's of Essex for to get a drink. He was sitting in the hedge reading and writing, and this man was putting up hay in little pikes of hay, and he said, "You're a cad killing yourself," he says. "You'll be dead and there won't be a word about you, but when I die, I'll be famous." So that is it. Paddy is famous now, when he's dead.
Well, he'd have many friends in Carrickmacross.
Oh, he would. He would. He'd come to Carrickmacross. He would have friends. But people would be trying to move away from him. You know, afraid he'd write something about them. If they were selling a cow or selling, which was fair that time, or an animal. But all has changed now. If they see me telling this...
Rosanna, how's the day going so far?
It's been a great day. Of course, the weather has helped as well. But we've been going from location to location, and there's been so much support from everybody. Lots of photographs, and it's just been a really memorable occasion.
Yeah, it's been a great day. It's also a very exciting occasion for myself. My mother said it's time I settled down and find a wife. And, well, say no more. You know where I am. I must give you the mobile. Yeah. No, on a more serious note.
Despite his centrality as a writer, Kavanagh never inspired the summer schools and literary gatherings that other Irish writers have. This year, that all changed as a National Kavanagh Day and a series of events to commemorate his life were inaugurated.
And I'm very delighted to be here in Inishkeen, the pleasant land, today, to officially open the Raglan Road Festival as part of the Patrick Kavanagh centenary celebrations. This new festival in Patrick Kavanagh's native parish, of course, will be one of the highlights on the calendar of events marking his centenary year. As a result, local people and people from much further afield will be treated to an impressive lineup of world-class artists. This festival of music, poetry and song will celebrate the life and work of Patrick Kavanagh in his native Inishkeen, from where he drew much of the inspiration for his work. The Ireland of today is very different from the one into which Patrick Kavanagh was born in 1904. Since his death in 1967, we have witnessed great changes, and we are continuing to evolve. Ireland today is fast becoming a pluralist, multicultural society. A key player, as was revealed very strongly recently, a key player on the European and global stages. For a relatively small island, Ireland has always been seen as a place with a great cultural tradition. Cavna was trying to do what we all do in our everyday lives, celebrate the good and challenge that which we want to see improved. So finally, all that is left for me to do is to congratulate strongly all of those involved in putting together the inaugural Raglan Road Festival. And now, if you will permit me, I will be delighted to end by giving you a rendition of one of my favourite pieces of Cavna's work. And as a Derry man, I prefer to give it only one way, not by talking to you, but by singing to you. On Raglan Road, on an autumn day, I saw her first.
So we are inaugurating a new Cavna Day, which will hopefully become an annual event, taking place on the second Sunday of July each year. At this very moment, groups are assembled around the country to revisit Cavna's poetry and prose with renewed affection. Sligo, Monaghan, Armagh, Louth, Galway, Clare, Tipperary, Westmeath, Waterford and Dublin are counties with special readings today. Next year, I hope to see more counties involved, and Waterways Ireland have kindly agreed to support Cavna Day readings next year. The best poem to start with today is The Lines Written on the Seat on the Grand Canal Bank. O commemorate me where there is water, canal water preferably, so stilly greeny at the heart of summer.
The Patrick Cavna Centre in the poet's native Inniskeen seeks to emphasise the importance of the poet's birthplace in his work, as indeed he did himself. Tour guide and storyteller Jean Carroll at times seems to inhabit the very world that Cavna came from.
We are now going on a little tour of the Cavna country, places that he mentioned in his poetry, round Billy Brennan's barn, Shanko Duff, Rock Savage, Kidnamincha and Mocher. I suppose you could say now, to get back to reality again, or Cavna, that we're on the Inniskeen Road. The Inniskeen Road, where the bicycles went by in twos and threes to the dance in Billy Brennan's barn. This is the Inniskeen Road we're on now. If you look ahead of you there, you see what Cavna, where he mentioned that in his poem, where he quoted Alexander Selkirk. A road, a mile of kingdom, I am king of banks and stones and every blooming thing. You just stop down here now. Go slow now.
Did he like the land? Did he eventually like the land?
The land wasn't for him at all. He wasn't interested.
But why did he write such a nice poem about it?
Well, you see, he loved the land for, I suppose, its poetry and its beauty.
Okay, so he didn't like it for the work?
Didn't like it for the work on it.
Okay.
The little out farm that Cavna's bought in 1926, to the amazement of the neighbours. They said Cavna's must have got a legacy from America. So those were the Black Hills, he said, that had never seen the sun rising. He said eternally they looked north towards Armagh. Lot's wife would not be sought if she had been incurious as my Black Hills. Yeah. And then you can see this is the triangular feel. He talks about it in another beautiful poem, Innocence. He said, they laughed at one I loved, the triangular hill that hung under the big fort. They said I was bounded by the white thorn hedges of the little farm and did not know the world, but I knew that love's doorway to life is the same doorway everywhere. So that's it. And the big fort was on the Rock Savage land. Now, the Rock Savage estate was a 300-acre farm owned by the Plunkett Kennys, who were of the line of St. Oliver Plunkett. And when Cavna was a young fellow, they were elderly, so they were leasing the land to the locals. So Cavna's family would have taken a few acres of, on Conacre, as we call it here, as well. So he would have spent an awful lot of time in this area, and this was a beautiful place for someone.
Well, I'm the administrator here at the Cavna Centre.
We cater for the schools as well as the regular casual visitor. Because Cavan is on the junior and leaving certificate courses, we bring a lot of schools come in here and do the tour of Cavan country and view the exhibition, and they get to hear Jean's one-man show as well.
Where the divil did I put me cap?
Well, of all the main men that ever was, you're the mainest. I'm a holiday morning to be looking for the old cap at 25 minutes past 8.
On an apple-ripe September morning, through the mist-chilled fields I went, with a pitchfork on me shoulder, less for use than for divilment. The thrashing
Are you going to mass at all, or do you mean to be home with them itself?
Did any of you see my cap?
Anything to be late for mass. If it wasn't the cap, it'd be something else. The stud or there'd be a button off the coat. Just like your Uncle Petey that never give himself more than 5 minutes to walk to mass. I remember him, and he'd keep looking at himself and looking at himself in the looking glass till, honest to God, it'd make a body throw off their guts to see
him. Nah, don't be bothering me.
Oh, that's your Uncle Petey all over. Nobody could talk to him either. He knew everything. You lick a leg. He'd gone to put a leg in a horse and the whole country laughing at him. You're the spitting image of him. A right Rodney your Uncle Petey was, if ever there was one. Never had a halfpenny to his name except a lock of old rags and a couple of books.
Maybe he'll leave me the books, whatever.
Will you get down to hell of that and go to mass?
He spent a couple of years toing and froing. He really wanted to settle in London, but he couldn't afford to live in London. So he came back, really was meant to be briefly to Dublin, to write a potboiler to fulfil the obligations over... The Green Fool had had a libel case, and the publisher said Kavanagh owed him money and he owed him the next book. So Kavanagh came to write that book and discharge his obligation, write anything just to discharge his obligation. But he was caught by the war. He moved into Dublin in August to write that book, and in September the war broke out. And, faute de mieux, he became a Dublin writer, which I think was one of the best things that could have happened to him. Because if he had stayed in London, he'd have been, I think, even somebody as independent as him, I think he might have been a bit overwhelmed by the London scene, and that he might have felt he had to pander to it somewhat.
In 1930, he decided he'd go to Dublin. He came in one day to his dinner and he said to the mother as he sat down to the dinner, thinking of going on a bit of a journey. Musha, she said, to where? That was a great word, a horse, Musha. As far as Dublin, he said. Good God, she said. What will you think of next? It'd fit you better if you cleaned the drain down at the bottom of the yarn and not have it flooding us out in the winter time. I don't give a damn, he said, if the water in the drain rises as high as the flood that floated Noah over or at, I'm going to Dublin. And she saw that his mind was made up. And she gave him all the money that was in the house at the time. 3 shillings and 4 pence halfpenny of old money. Of the old money. You know what that'd be now? And he started off for Dublin walking.
But where would any year of commemoration be without controversy? And the life, death and legacy of Patrick Kavanagh have been surrounded by controversy.
But the third factor I have to say is that Kavanagh's work is not being distributed properly in the States. Insofar as it has been distributed in the States, it's been distributed from Peter Kavanagh's hand press. And there's a problem about distributing the poetry in particular, which is the work of Kavanagh we would mainly like to be distributing, because Peter Kavanagh is claiming copyright in 20 of Kavanagh's poems, and they happen to be include some of his best poems, and you simply cannot publish a collected or a selected poems even without these poems. So although we have the centenary edition of collected poems being published this October, it will not be distributed in the United States.
Under a very good relationship. In fact, Peter has invited them to his talk, which is taking place in Trinity College on the 22nd of July. And he's invited all the members in the centre to go to that. So hopefully we're all going, of course. And we'll meet Peter there. And it'll be I'm looking forward to that because I'm sure he's a controversial character and we never know what he might come up with, but however, you have to go and listen.
I speak only for Patrick Kavanagh. I am his ghost here tonight. And that he believed in the divinity, so that what he hoped to get was a flash of that beatific vision, that something called supernatural grace. That is what he sought for. In poetry, the words are the least important part of it. Words have virtually nothing to do with it. The words of poetry, if it's a poem, the words burn up and you no longer see the words, but you get this tremendous thrill of something unusual. And that is where I stand in relation. So that if I say that there is no poet in Ireland today, it is because it's based on that situation. And indeed, Patrick said many times that he wouldn't object if they said he wasn't a poet at all. But all these versifiers, they're all poets, according to themselves, but not according to my my standard. How is that? I would like to discuss a very important situation which affects every person in this audience. In 1967, shortly after Patrick's death, I left my university professorship, including pension and other benefits, to devote my life to a moral obligation. Between 1967 and 1980, I collected, revised, edited, and published what has come to be the canon of Patrick Kavanagh's work. 7 months before Patrick died, he married Catherine Maloney, who never demonstrated to me any interest in the publication of Patrick's work. Indeed, there were no works, just a stack of papers, with no continuity, no form. That is how Patrick operated. And that is what he left me, a heap. Using an ordinary steam iron, it took me the best parts of a year to smooth the pages and scraps so they could be arranged, collated, edited.
You can just pull into the left here at the gateway. You'll be okay there, I'd say. That'll do lovely. Okay, now, here we are now. That's Kavanagh's homestead as you see it today. Now, that's not the house that Paddy Kavanagh was born in. No. Paddy Kavanagh was born in a small, two-roomed, thatched cottage. Mm-hmm. The property of his grandmother, Nancy Callan.
I'm sitting here next to the niece of Patrick Kavanagh. Caelan, how does it feel for you to be in Enniskeen in this centenary year?
My family and I got a bit of a laugh driving down off the main Dundalk Road to this big weekend, and they didn't even have a sandwich board out to say, turn here. And the first sign of it was right smack in the middle of the village, so I don't exactly know what kind of celebration they're having, but it's certainly not well publicized. And I stay out of the village if I can. For many reasons, probably the same reasons that my uncle got out and my father got out, because the village is not a particularly friendly place for Kavanaghs, unfortunately. So I stay here in the back garden of the Comiskeys, my dear friends, and I stay out in my own yard, and that's about as far as I go, as far as Enniskeen and the centenary. And we just took a nice hour-long walk down, is it the Bog Road? I guess it's the Bog Road, isn't it? Kenny's or... Yeah. So I take private walks around, but I try and stay out of Enniskeen. I love the hills. I love the fields. And I love that house down there. And we enjoy our friends here, the Comiskeys, and it would be a sad place and a cold place to come if you didn't have your friends here. So I'm really more attached to my friends than I am to the area. So I suppose if we relocated this whole gig to the south of France, I'd be going there instead of coming here. So it's my friends that bring me back, really, not any attachment to the Kavanagh legacy.
Do you have a certain responsibility being the niece of such a great poet?
I would say the answer to that is no. I actually have no literary background at all. I'm just a lawyer, and I've read very little about it. I defend my father and his rights, and we continue to fight a very heavy battle, and to that extent I'm involved, but as far as being involved in the literary side of it, no. I'm the legal side. I'm the business side of it. But as long as the people who have been enemies of my father are allowed to continue doing what they're doing, you're only going to get the minimal information on Patrick that you now have. And I'm shocked that any of you are shocked that you didn't know this, because clearly you walk into a bookstore, you can't get any of my father's books. So the surprise to me is incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. Nobody's been looking, obviously. I stepped into the center for the first time last night to listen to a performance by two fellows whose names escape me at the moment. And I had gone down because friends of mine had said that there's a new group in town and that they're enthusiastic for my father and that they want to be friendly. And I had to get out of the performance because a half an hour into it, they started to insult my father most egregiously, claiming that he was a money grabber and that I think there's some discussion about the manuscripts going to UCD and that my father, basically got $100,000 for it and loves the smell of money and so on and so forth, which was quite unbelievable for a group that's supposed to be enthusiastic about my father to say this. And these fellows knew I was in the audience. So they couldn't resist the urge to insult me. And I got up and walked out. The obligation of those people who want to discover this poet and want to learn from the source, which is my father, not the trustees, not the widow. I have my own life to live in New York. My father has his own life to live. He's 89 years old. He's not going to engage in any more of this nonsense. We've had it. And if there are people who are truly interested here in Ireland, which I certainly have not seen other than in Trinity College, it was for the first time I've ever seen any interest on the part of my father, in my father and in his work, then come forward and do something about it. But we're finished. We're not doing it. We have our own lives in New York. My understanding is that a court order has been issued, and I think it was on a default judgment, ordering that all rights in Patrick's work rest in the trustees of the estate of the widow. And that's the end of it.
Catherine made a will, and she was very anxious that the money from Kavanagh's works should not go to her family, but should benefit Irish poets in general. And she left her money for that purpose, and we have made a number of awards to Irish poets. There was a problem about the copyright in that Dr. Peter Kavanagh was apparently claiming to own the copyright in some of Kavanagh's works. And this was rather mysterious. We never understood on what basis he was making this claim. But as his widow, Catherine, inherited his estate, and the only thing that was in his estate, the only thing he owned, was the rights to his work. I suppose I should say about the copyright also that we were concerned not just to vindicate our claim to as Catherine's trustees to owning the copyright, but also to the quality of the what was published. We were very anxious that what was published should be the same as what Kavanagh wrote.
She was very, very good to him and very fond of him. And she was the only woman he ever lived with. Of you know all the women he had had various friendships and relationships with over the years. So I think that it, in the end, partly I think that he was just on. He stayed a bachelor as long as he could, you know, but he was just unable to look after himself, and Catherine was happy to look after him. She was really magnanimous and was willing to take him as he was, with all his faults and his drunkenness and so on, and she really, really cared for him. Now, some people would say he wasn't an alcoholic. I think that's very, very hard to deny. He was, shall we say, drinking very heavily indeed, and that had begun back in 1955, just before the operation, when he was in pain, and that he began drinking at that point. And he was really an alcoholic by the 1960s.
When Catherine then died, she was taken up to Inniskeen to be buried. There was objections because the family felt she wasn't close enough to Patrick.
There was only one member of the family who felt that, and that was the brother Peter. According to Catherine's will, she wished to be buried with her husband, which is a normal Irish practice. But a cable arrived from Peter in the United States, saying that she wasn't to be put in the grave. The local people were so afraid of getting involved in family disputes that they dug a grave beside the local grave. And it was, in fact, Mary Kavanagh, Patrick's sister, surviving sister, who said, "That is my grave. That is not Patrick's grave." And the solicitor was there, John Jay, and he took out the will and said she's supposed to be buried with her husband. So everybody had to adjourn to the village hall for 3 hours while the grave was dug.
And she was buried then?
And she was buried then with her husband. The grave is not marked, and that's another story.
Why is the grave not marked?
Peter came back and discovered that despite his cable and wishes to the contrary, Catherine had been buried with Patrick. He had placed stepping stones and a cross on the original grave. So he came and took away the stepping stones and the cross and set up an alternative grave, minus the corpse, in the garden of the family home. And the grave lay unmarked for several years. And eventually, Catherine's sister, Helen Maloney, who was a stained glass artist, commissioned a sculptor friend of hers to make a headstone, which he did. And then, some summers ago, while Peter Kavanagh was holidaying in Inniskeen, the gravestone was smashed into small pieces with a sledgehammer. Patrick married Catherine without ever telling Peter he was getting married. And he kept Peter in complete ignorance of Catherine's existence. He actually wrote letters to Peter from Catherine's flat in London, giving the address, but not indicating that this was his woman partner.
Kavanagh yearned to escape from Inniskeen. He famously walked to Dublin to launch his career as a writer. In Dublin, he didn't altogether fit in, an obvious countryman, a little gauche, not quite the literary figure. But what matters for any writer, beyond how they are regarded as a writer? And in Inniskeen, Kavanagh's fellow writers met and commemorated him.
Well, I think we appropriately fear great writers. If you're to be a great writer, as Kavanagh was, you step outside the collective. You break all the rules. You mention topics that are unmentionable. We, the Irish, like many as a tribe, are terrified of the great writer.
There's something interesting happening in Ireland. As you know, the Catholic Church, or the Irish Catholic Church, which one should nearly distinguish from the Roman Catholic Church, because it's a local branch which had an extraordinary kind of nationalistic aspect. But it's beginning, it has weakened under scandal, and it seems to be disappearing to some extent, almost like snow off a rope. And into this sudden void, you've got writers are being elevated into the place of saints. So you've got St. Joyce, you've got St. James Joyce, who was the King of Dublin, actually crowned. And then you've Beckett, also, and it's easy to make Saint Samuel. And I think Kavanagh is coming up as another saint. This kind of process of canonization, which is happening to the writers, who, when you think of John Charles McQuaid and his power over the country, and his strange friendship, of course, with Kavanagh. But now, who cares about John Charles, whereas they're concerned about Patrick, to whom they're looking for spirituality, which, of course, John Charles was supposed to give us.
I know a lot of writers who have damn old time for the other world. One of them, indeed, has the name James Joyce, who's on record as saying, the only esprit that interests me is l'esprit d'escalier. And when I read him, I find that to be true, and I'm disappointed. And that, it seems to me, is why Kavanagh, when I heard him speaking in the fabled series of lectures in UCD in the year 1954, said in response to a question, "Ulysses, that compendium of commonplaces." The Joyce industry is a 20th century phenomenon that doesn't interest me particularly. But Kerr's Big Ass interests me, and Antenatal Dream interests me. And that Kavanagh note is inspirational and abiding. Kavanagh's hour will come. There's no doubt at all about that.
Absolutely deteriorating rapidly.
For me, I'm a native of Inneskeen, and I'm working with the Kavanagh Centre. I think it's brilliant that we take Kavanagh home. Kavanagh was sort of rejected when he was living in Inneskeen, and now it's our chance to bring him home and commemorate him where he should really be commemorated, on the banks of the Féin.
How important is Kavanagh to the people of Inneskeen?
It's a new generation that are looking at a space and time that has been captured completely by Kavanagh. Rural Ireland, the rural peasant farmer, the existence, the poor existence that he lived in, and it's been appreciated now that, you know, the rapid pace of life and things are going so fast, the people can actually connect back and capture that, and I think nobody has captured it better in Ireland than Patrick Kavanagh. It's amazing, if you do the Kavanagh trail around, you will, the fields that inspired his particular poetry are still intact. You know, Billy Brennan's barn is still there. The church that inspired much of his work and his, the hassle he lived with his faith and his religion at the time, is hosts the Kavanagh Centre at the moment. So it's relatively unchanged, apart from extra houses and telegram wires and all the rest of it.
Mobile phones.
Mobile phones. But no, it's relatively unchanged, and people can still capture the whole essence of what, like, I mean, Casti's Hanging Hill. Kavanagh didn't write fiction. Kavanagh wrote what he saw, and it's still here to be seen today, and it's a jewel in the crown of the North East.
If you think if Kavanagh came back to Inneskeen today, what would he make of the place?
No, I hope he'd play pitch and putt.
Well, I mean, you have to start with making sure that his poetry is read in schools by young people who will become enthusiasts and will grow up and will say, oh, I love Patrick Kavanagh, and people will get together and study him and talk about him. I mean, that's really what it's all about. It's about the people, not about these intellectuals who are trying to make a business out of it. It's about, isn't it about the spirituality and what does the poetry bring to you, the individual? What does it mean to you when you're reading through the verse?
Well, of course, Kavanagh is remembered. It's extraordinary how many people know his poetry and want to talk about it and feel a kind of ownership of Kavanagh's poetry in a way that I think a lot of other Irish poets, they just don't have that kind of relationship with their readers. We have managed to nail quite a number of translations, and that's good. There's been a Greek translation of The Great Hunger. There's a French Terry Flynn, and I think an Argentine Terry Flynn, which, of course, will circulate in all the Spanish-speaking countries. I hope he'd be pleased with how he's being remembered. I think he found Dublin very glossy and flashy, even in the 30s and 40s. And 50s. It may look very small and parochial looking back now. But I also think there's some of Kavanagh's Dublin left down by the Grand Canal, and I think it would be nice for him to know that those things are still there.
I have lived in important places, times when great events were decided. Who owned that half a rood of rock and no man's land surrounded by our pitchfork-armed claims? I heard the Duffys shouting, "Damn your soul," and old McCabe stripped to the waist seam, stepped the plot-defying blue cast steel. Here is the march along these iron stones. That was the year of the Munich bother, which was most important. I inclined to lose my faith in Ballyrush and Gorchon, till Homer's ghost came whispering to my mind. He said, "I made the Iliad from such a local row. Gods make their own importance."
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.